Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2026. Welcome to Deep Program with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. Hey, JT, how are you?
I'm doing okay. What's going on, man? You doing okay this morning?
I'm doing okay. And our colleague, Manila Chan, is in hospital right now delivering her child.
Is she?
She is.
Wow.
Yeah. 45 years old.
Manila. Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, so TMI show still goes on doing that in the 10 o'clock hour, but Robbie, you'll be sitting in. I've chose some topics that will
fit. The Manila was going to be doing it from the emergency room or from the hospital.
Well, if she was, truly professional, no right. Work ethic, that one. Anyway, all right. So please like, follow, and share the show. A lot going on today, so we should just get into it. I mean, there's always a lot going on, but this is just, you know, it does not make that untrue. Coming up at 9:30, we're going to have a special guest, journalist Murtaza Hussein, who broke this story on Drop Site News, is going to talk about the details of a secret mutual defense treaty between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Obviously, with Pakistan serving as the intermediary between Iran and the United States, and Saudi Arabia being right. Iran's biggest enemy in the Middle East, that has some major foreign policy implications. Join us in 25 minutes to talk to Murtaza, and he and we will be taking your questions during that time. Speaking of which, if you do have any questions for either JT or myself, just pop them into the live chat on YouTube or Rumble, 9 a.m. In the 9 a.m. Eastern hour if you're watching live. Otherwise, you know, you can post them in the comments section on YouTube or Rumble, and we will get to those the next day. Priority will go to the super chats. I'm trying to think if there's any other housekeeping to know about. I didn't hear back from you guys. Are you guys going to do Q&A without me? Because I can't do it today at 12 noon.
Maybe. So I have a doctor's appointment at 1. I just realized.
Oh, okay. Is it far away?
Yesterday, and I just remembered the fact that it was yesterday. It was too late in the day to give a heads up. Mm-hmm. I'm not against it, though. I can
maybe do a shorter version.
1. It shouldn't take 30 minutes to get to the doctor's office.
All right. So maybe. Well. Okay, but it's at 12 noon is the Q&A, so.
Right.
So maybe just do a half-hour one with Robbie.
That works. I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no issue with
that. All right, let me just ask. Let me put you guys together. Robbie, is that cool? Q&A, yeah, half an hour Q&A?
Or we can skip it and reschedule for tomorrow.
I can't do tomorrow because I've got DMZ tomorrow.
Oh, it'll have to be Friday.
Friday works.
Yay. I've got something Friday.
Listen, nobody wants to talk to me.
No, that's not true at all. Anyway, it's only half an hour. But anyway, look, you guys work it out. And
yeah, we'll figure it out.
Let the world know what you guys want to do.
No, listen, we're going to make the sausage right here live and in color.
But, I feel like the Yenta here. Like, come on. Like, Robbie's a lovely boy. JT, you'll love him. Robbie, you'll love JT. He's awesome.
Hey, I love JT.
And I'll throw in a couple of goats to sweeten the pot.
I don't worship Baal. I don't need goats.
they make good food and milk too. Actually, I love goat cheese.
Oh yeah.
See, I've never had goat cheese, and I've never
had. Have you ever
had goat cheese? Mm-mm. Huh? How come?
Yeah.
I mean, it must have been offered to you on numerous occasions.
I mean, when I was abroad, they had it, but it wasn't something that I actually sought out.
Anyone approach you in a dark alley and say like, come on, little boy. You know you want some goat cheese. Come on.
that would be very awkward. That would be very weird.
Very strange.
Seriously, that you'll ever have is raccoon. If you've never had raccoon is awesome. It's a little bit salty.
But I like salty.
The best way to do raccoon, though, is that you got to dress it out right away. Grill it. Just slow it on the grill. Put some bacon grease down there on the irons.
I've never processed, Robbie. I got to be honest. I've never processed an animal, right? So like, I've processed a fish. I've scaled fish.
Like skinning an animal. Oh yeah,
I've never. Yeah, like dead. Take a dead animal, cut off its fur, and then like, you know, I don't. I've seen that done. I don't know how to do it though.
Well, at the end of the world, I will be fighting my cousin who knows how to do that stuff, right?
Well, it depends on the animal, right? I mean, for most of them, unless some of you have a show, who cares? But what you do, you get a knife. The best thing you do is just you cut an X in the fur, and then you just roll the skin off. And then once you get the skin actually done, then you cut from the anus up to the chest, and then you just pull the guts out. Easy to do, and then you just kind of go in, just kind of quarter it. After me and Kizzy first got married,
but you have to get rid of all of the yucky organs too, right? Like the stomach and the intestines.
Well, that's why. But you get the skin off first, and then after me and Kizzy got married, the first thing I did is I fed her squirrel and rice.
And she still married you?
She did.
Right.
All right. It's like most interesting. This is what this is what happens when you date a white guy. They're all like this.
Listen, not just a white guy from the deep South. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference. Cause Ted, last time I checked, you're a white dude. You are like the yankiest Yankee I've ever seen in my life. No offense. I love you, brother. But I mean,
I could treat you. If only I introduced you. I mean, I hear your point. I'm not claiming not to be super white, but if I introduced you to my old classmates at Columbia who went to Phillips Exeter, Andover, and these like prep school, these Northeastern prep schools, holy shit. I mean, they are like Nick Lowe's song said, so white, refrigerator white. Everything's about you, refrigerator white.
But see, here's the thing though. I'm a redneck from the deep South and the blood of the Confederacy flows through my veins. And so that is a heritage that I just fully just embrace. I am talking to a black dude about this. Does not matter. Y'all see this right here. It just is what it is. My son.
Well, I think JT gets to decide whether it matters.
Well, it doesn't matter to me. But my son,
it's individual, right?
Yeah, for sure. My son, I mean, he's like me, but with a much darker tan. And he's more redneck than I am. And it's a great thing to see. It's awesome.
There's Thomas. Redneck and then there's Confederate, and they're not the same.
Right.
Oh, son is a hardcore Confederate, too.
I mean, keep in mind, I was born and raised in Richmond, like the home of the Confederacy.
Why was the capital of the Confederacy in Richmond? Doesn't it seem like dangerous to have it so close to the North?
It's because Virginia was the richest and most populous state. And so that's why. And also,
it would have been wiser to have it like in Western Tennessee or something.
You got to think about the mythology, right? The majority of the founding fathers, especially the founding presidents, were Virginians. And George Washington was the first. Light Horse Harry Lee, who was Washington's right hand, was Robert E. Lee's dad. So that connection to the Revolution is like right there. That's why.
I mean, so question, and we'll move on and talk about real shit. Although this is real shit. What happened? If you capture Paris, you've captured France, right? Yeah. If you capture Moscow, pretty much you've captured Russia. These are centralized societies. If you captured Richmond, did you automatically capture? Well, France is centralized. France is a centralized country.
Right.
If you capture Berlin, you have Germany. Maybe in Russia, maybe not. Point taken. If you captured Richmond, did that mean game over for the South?
No, it was decentralized. The whole issue with the South is that it was so devastated by 1865 is that the war was effectively over in 1864, but it was kind of cursed with the German invasion of the Soviet Union. I mean, it took a year for them to figure it out and another 100,000 men dying. Yeah. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, we'll have a historical lesson of the Civil War later on. All right, or the battle between War of Northern Aggression, as you call it.
Aggression.
Yeah, War of Northern Aggression.
The first time I heard that, I was in Longwood, and you know, yeah, I knew I was in the South, but there's the South and there's the South.
Right.
And I remember having
there are striations. Right.
There are striations, right? There are parts of Virginia that you go to where their accent is deeper than Robbie's, right? Where it's like, wait a minute, am I still in Virginia? She, for one, she was attractive, which always is a negative.
That helps.
And she's like, we're having this conversation, and she brings up this notion of the War of Northern Aggression. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And she's like, the War of Northern Aggression, we were attacked. And I'm like, okay. Fair enough.
But she was cute, so.
Yeah, you're trapped, could be so I'm going to ignore all of this, right? Yeah,
I had this friend. He was a very Jewish punk rocker, and great guy, George. And he told me this story about, like, in punk rock scene, there was always a substrata of, like, neo-Nazis. And he told me how, like, some neo-Nazi girl, like, picked him up at a bar, and he ended up, like, boning her in, like, his van. And then he realized, he pulled out and came on her swastika tattoo. And he said that just, and I was like, your grandparents would be so proud.
Yeah, for sure.
And and he was like, he said, like, oh my God, I felt so great about that. And I was like, okay, all right.
Not JT, I've got to tell you this, and then we'll go, because I guess we have a show that we got to do.
Oh, that's too funny. Sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
Our wedding, when I got married with Kizzy, it was epic, because my family is just white trash. I mean, not just redneck. I mean, just straight on meth head white trash. Like, as far if you think stereotypical hick, that's my stock back home. Okay. And then, of course, here I am marrying a black woman, and her family, like her mom and grandmother, of course, they grew up there in segregation and stuff. And so we all got to this church, and these are going to be a very entertaining wedding, or it's going to turn into a race war. It was going to be one or the other. And we had no idea how this was going to go. And it was just it was the nicest wedding. Everyone got along after it. They were just, everyone just hanging out.
Clearly.
We had no idea, though, like, what was it's kind of like with water and sodium. If you put the two of them together, bad things don't tend to happen. Right. We did not know what was going to happen here. And it just turned out just to be such a good time. I think we set race relations forward probably like 100 years in Northwest Florida.
Alcohol can do that. A race, I mean, the family just wants you to treat her, right?
Oh no. Oh no. Some of her folks were very, very not happy with her taking up with the white guy. Like, none at all. It was just like, you are literally with the enemy here.
Usually I see it the other way around, right? Like when you're dating a white woman and black women are looking at you like, you motherfucker.
When I first started dating Kizzy, I went for a walk with her mama, and we were walking around and we were talking, and she expressed her concerns. And I was like, Miss Maudell, I said, listen, I understand. I said, I love you. I said, but you'd understand, I ain't asking to marry you. I'm asking to marry your daughter. That's the difference. And I said, I love her. I'll take good care of her. So I'll do everything I can to make sure that she has everything she needs, that she's the happiest woman in the world. But I mean, I can't change what I am. You can't change what you are. And even if I could, I wouldn't do it.
Right.
And it's like, well, sounds good, Robbie. But if you ever get tired of her, please don't kill her. Just bring her home.
Is that what she said for
that
real?
That is 100% what she said. And I said, I'll 100% make you that promise. I won't kill her and I'll bring her home. But I'm not going to take her back to the pound. God. Okay.
Don't kill her. Just bring her home.
Oh, my God. And with that, I'm
I mean, we are like the there. But I mean, me and Maudell, I mean, honest to God, I love that woman. And I told y'all the story last week. You know, poor thing. She's fighting dementia and stuff right now. She's just like, Robbie, you're my favorite white person. I said, you're my second favorite black person.
Does she know any others?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Just checking. All right.
Were you the only one?
Are you the only cracker she knows?
I'm a journalist. You got to fact check this. Yeah, all right, Robbie. Yeah. You can stay on, but we've got to talk about. We've got to get on. And actually, we'll find you some comments. Okay. All right. So listen. It turns out, remember last week, Donald Trump said there's. I'm not even going to run through. We're just going to hit the stories. So last week, Trump was threatening no more Mr. Nice Guy. And well, it turns out there is a Mr. there is actually more Mr. Nice Guy. So Trump blinked again. Another Taco Tuesday 2.0. Actually, maybe 3.0 by now.
Yep.
It's 3.0. And anyway, so here's the story, right? It's very clear now to all but the most insane MAGA supporters that there is no master plan here. Donald Trump has been bluffing all along. He knows that Iran has all the advantages. JT, just a couple of minutes ago, USA Today reported that Iran fired at three straight ships in the Strait of Hormuz and also seized two ships in the Strait of Hormuz and brought them over to an Iranian port. No word on which countries those ships belong to. Obviously, the Strait of Hormuz has never been more closed ever.
Right.
So, you know, the challenge now for everybody concerned is how to frame any kind of post-war agreement in a way that doesn't make Donald Trump look like the loser that he is. And I don't know I guess there must be a way to thread this needle, but that's hard. And once again, he's like, you know, the military's raring to go, we'll bomb them. But I mean, at this point, the boy has cried and screamed and shouted wolf so many times that we have to kind of think, you don't have the cards, Donald. You don't have them.
No, right? I know. I would like to point out that I was right.
You were right.
There was no way Iran could negotiate under these terms because it's like if I kick you in the balls and then you sit down and it's like, all right, let's negotiate. What does it mean if you do, right? It's like, I've just kicked you in the balls. You better take your sore balls and go home. Otherwise, they're going to look at you and say, they're weak. And it's like, even if you want to negotiate, how do you do it under these terms, right? You have a moderate, quote unquote, government that's in office. They want to negotiate, even clashing against the IRGC and the hardliners in this particular situation. But how do you do it? Because the moment that I sit down, it's like, dude, you've been stealing my ships. You have a blockade that's going on. There is no ceasefire in Iran or in the Middle East in the context of Lebanon. None of these things have happened. And if I sit down after basically saying these are my preconditions, what do you view me as in this case? You view it as I'm sitting down because I have to, right? Which is not the signal that I want to give. It makes the war longer and it makes the negotiation even that much worse or that much harder, because now I'm dealing with this notion that you're looking at me as if I'm prey. Yeah, the strongest position that they took was silence. We're not talking to you under these terms. And God bless them for it. God bless them.
Yeah, I'm glad that they took this approach. And I guess my concern is that the highly emasculated, totally gelded, majorly cucked Donald Trump is going to feel a need to reestablish his Y chromosome by nuking something. And that's my only concern.
Yeah. I mean, look, man, it is a concern. I have a hard time wrapping my head around the U.S. attacking a non-nuclear state with nukes. Is it possible?
Well, it did it before.
True. But that was in the middle of a war where life was had very little value. I mean, we're talking about 50 million people dying, right? What does it matter if you add in another 100,000 to 30, 40, 50 million people? I mean, I'm not saying that that's nothing. I'm just saying in the context of a struggle that was total against the Germans, and let's be honest, from the standpoint of the United States, we got nukes, might as well see what they look like, and let's, you know, scare the shit out of the Russians or the Soviets. I guess I'm saying it's different. It's not the same. I don't know. Look, you could be right. And this could be something that Trump comes up with. I would hope there's somebody in the room saying no. But is it possible? Sure, it's possible. But I get the sense. I mean, did you see, there was a reporting that came out, I believe it was CNN, and they were talking about the munitions that the United States effectively utilized in this war. 50% of THAAD interceptors utilized, 50% of Patriots, 45% of precision strike missiles, 30% of Tomahawk missiles, 20% of JSOMs, 20% of Standoff. He used all of this in like, what, 2 months?
Mm-hmm.
Modern war.
Yeah. We had to ask the Yukis for some of our stuff back.
It's amazing.
And the Yukis don't have it because, you know what they do with our stuff. They don't really fire that much of it at the Ruskies. They sell it on the dark web. So
make a buck, make a profit. It's a hell of a, it would be to expend this much material for this little results. And not just this little results. It's even worse than that because Iran took the Strait of Hormuz, something that wasn't true before the war started.
Right. Yeah. Let's not forget that. Right. Like, if Donald Trump has a colossal victory, he winds up right back where he started.
Yes.
If he wins, yeah. I mean, that's piss poor.
I mean, the question becomes, how does he extricate himself from this? Because the problem is, a U.S. president is loath to accept the fact that they failed. And even if you're looking at the Ukraine war, for example, right? It's clear as day that Ukraine has lost that war. Mm-hmm. And yet it rolls on. And even I accept that Trump may want a deal, but he can never accept the deal under the terms to which Russia would give him, because losers don't get to dictate terms. And I feel the same way with the Iran thing, with the difference is Iran doesn't have nukes. So the catch becomes, back to your court, are nukes utilized as a wild card last resort in order to avoid humiliation?
Well, I know you don't buy this. I'm just wondering, now that you've had a chance to think about it a little more, if you've changed your mind. No offense if you haven't. But what do you think of my theory, my advice to the president, that he transform this into a grand bargain and say, listen, we're gonna normalize relations. That doesn't have to look like a surrender. It can look like a, listen, you know how, like, the cliche, two guys get into a bar fight, they hate each other, but then they, like, start to respect each other, and then they end up drinking and they become the best of friends, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's kind of what happened with me and Scott Stantis, minus the drinking and the and we used to hate each other, and we were combatants in the world of politics. Now we're best friends. He's on the right, I'm on the left. Who cares? I mean, isn't it possible for Trump to say, listen, I thought it over. Fighting with the Iranians is stupid. I thought about all the money America could make. We could sell them stuff. We can do business, make a deal. It's like, bring them into the fold. It's a big win for us. I mean, honestly, that's not so hard to frame.
See, it's running against inertia. Like, there's political inertia.
But Donald Trump runs against his whole career.
Or momentum,
about running against inertia, right?
You don't think so? Like, basically, that he would have to...
Well, you have to tell Bibi to fuck off. But,
well, there's that too.
But who cares? I mean, like, no one likes Israel anymore. It's never coming back. The American people, Israel's dead to them. AIPAC has lost its power. They're done. So why not just? I mean, we can all see it coming.
That's such a change of direction.
It is.
Like, it's radical. I mean, like, not just radical. It is jarring. And I feel like it's jarring in a way, like, if Superman catches somebody falling off of a cliff, Superman is going to break their back. Right? They're moving at 9.8 meters per second squared, straight down. The Superman is like, here, we rescued you. And it's like, oh my God, this person is mush. I guess, look, from your mouth to God's ears, fair enough. I don't know how that works in our political space. What is Congress going to say? What is the media going to say? Look, I was at the Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin summit, right, where Joe Biden and Putin talk, because there was a situation of this concern that there was no communication between the two and that things could spiral out of control. Mm-hmm. I watched the media. Joe Biden gives a speech. Joe Biden sounds a lot like Putin in that speech, meaning they've obviously correlated what they were going to say. Mm-hmm. And I watched the media eat Joe Biden alive, screaming at him about, did you stick it to Putin? Did you tell Putin to fuck off? Did you talk about the Ukrainians? Did you talk about this? Did you talk about that? And Joe Biden, this is that moment where Joe Biden's so screaming at the reporter, saying, you don't understand the situation that we're dealing with. Like, that's what a U.S. president would have to deal with if a U.S. president all of a sudden...
But the difference is that Joe Biden had a sympathetic media before that happened, and he was worried about losing it. Donald Trump doesn't have a sympathetic media, so true. He's not losing anything.
It's the political issue. It's just hard for me to see it politically. I'm not saying you're wrong.
I think it's a simple matter of, like, anyone with clarity can see that this is what's in the cards. So the only question now is, when are you going to realize it and respond to it? Are you going to wait until it's upon you and, like, the wolf is eating your ass, or are you going to just, accept the reality and deal with it now? That's really the question. I mean, if you're Trump, it's to your advantage to accept it on the earlier side, because then it solves a bunch of your problems. I mean, first of all, cutting BB. You know, BB is a serious drag on his popularity, right? I mean, he's down at 35%. You and I know that just by cutting Israel loose, he'd be bounced up to back up to 40. You know, he's not going to lose MAGA world over that. And he'd pick up some people who, you know, are pissed off about Gaza and Israel and Iran. I mean, it would be good for him.
I do get it. But I think ultimately what you're going to see is he will need to try to find a way short of the quote nuclear option, right? And doing something just catastrophic. He would need to find a way to spin it. I mean, Trump has
for sure
no need for honesty or the truth, morality, good sense,
nope.
Rationality, any of those things. Nope. And he can walk out. Mark Sobota talks about this, how like Trump one time went out and was like, Ukraine, Zelensky is a dictator. And then the next day he's like, what? I never said that. And it's like, what? How do you do that? Right? Like, yes, most amazing. People don't have this Herculean ability to lie and just radical departure from the truth. Trump does. So obviously he's going to try to spin it. But I guess my biggest concern is that the ceasefire, it's not really a ceasefire. If you remember, in many other situations, Donald Trump used negotiations as a way of attack, basically saying lulling his opponent into this sense of complacency. Is that true this time? With the missile inventories, I don't know. And with what seems to be him being stuck in this situation, I don't know. What do you think about that, by the way? The chances of this kind of launching an attack under this guise of getting of lulling Iran into a false sense of security. Do you see that happening this summer?
Perhaps that's on. I mean, certainly it's a possibility. But the thing is, I don't think the Iranians are lullable at this point.
True.
You know, I mean, they've been through this down this primrose path a bunch of times with the Americans. They know they can't trust them at all. They've got to be at least mentally prepared for anything that comes, and probably militarily prepared for quite a bit. I mean, they know what the Americans are about. You know, I mean, at this point, I mean, and the Iranians are right. Anything short of an armistice is not going to cut it. I mean, they need something. And even that might not, you know, Donald Trump is so feckless. He might like ignore it, but bottom line is if I were them, I'd be like, if it's not signed in blood and engraved with multiple carbon copies, like, I don't know if I can take this seriously, right? It's like, it's got to be notarized, you know, DocuSigned, everything.
Agreed. I guess the question is, how do you do that? Like, I could see it potentially getting through a UN Security Council. That's assuming that, you know, you can even make a deal with the US in this case. But Congress?
Well, I mean, Congress is Trump's like butt boy. They'll do whatever the fuck he wants. Besides which, they don't. The thing is, even if it's a treaty, okay, and let's just say they don't ratify, so what? It's still like a president signed the treaty. The president's still bound by it, and it doesn't have the full force of American law as a Senate ratified treaty obligation. But it's still something that the U.S. that the Trump administration has to do. I mean, you know, you can, and in the world of in the court of international public opinion, like the U.S. would be fucked if it just like signed a peace treaty and then reneged. I mean,
why?
Because no one would ever believe anything the U.S. ever had to say ever again.
But they don't believe what they're. I mean, I guess that's the rub, right? Like, why would anybody trust anything that you? The U.S. has been pulling out one treaty after the next from the standpoint of the Soviet Union, all those missile treaties. And then if you look at the JCPOA, we just blew that off completely in its entirety. We attacked people in the middle of negotiations, and we continue and we backed a literal genocide. Why would blowing off a treaty obligation all of a sudden be the deal breaker? It's like, hey, everything was going well until this.
You might be right, but it's a whole new level. I mean, it's so like, because, I mean, a treaty obligation is so serious. I mean, at that point, then why have diplomacy, right? Like, why bother?
You don't have diplomacy. Like, okay. That's not the...
Why have
like,
it
they're going there and issuing demands. Empires are not, you know... Mm-hmm. I don't know. I see what we're doing is this kind of Hitlerian, like, radical breach of norms in regards to the way countries behave. We've gone rogue. And, I mean, we've been murdering fishermen in Venezuela. We literally kidnapped a world leader.
I know. Well, it's not even, and hilariously, it's not even the first time we've done it.
Yes, Manuel Noriega was another one, right?
I never understood that. Like, why does that guy go to a prison in Georgia? Like, how does that work?
It's random. That's what I mean, right? And the fact that
he's probably innocent, it doesn't help, but yeah.
I'm just saying, like, that's my point. Like, all of this shit is off the rails. Like, we're not in a normal operating space. What would be different with blowing off a tree?
You can't. Okay, well.
I could be wrong. I mean, look, I could be talking about that.
We have Murtaza waiting in the to join us. So let's go ahead and bring him on in.
Oh, right.
Murtaza Hussein, thanks for joining us on Deprogram.
Nice to see you, Ted. Nice to meet you, Jamal.
Nice to see you, too.
How's it going, man?
So we leaked documents, which you've been reporting on, reveal a secret pact between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, a mutual defense treaty. Let me introduce you. Murtaza Hussein is a journalist specializing in national security and foreign policy. He's a former reporter at The Intercept, now at Dropsite News. He offers commentary on U.S. interventions, human rights, and global affairs. He appears regularly on CNN, BBC, and MS Now. Still says MSNBC. We'll have to change that. Murtaza, tell us about this treaty and why it's important.
Yeah, so currently Pakistan is serving as a mediator in the talks between Iran and the U.S., ostensibly to end the war. The issue is that Pakistan, while serving theoretically as a neutral mediator, has deep ties to the U.S. as well, but also more critically, perhaps, to Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia is also participant in the war by virtue of the fact of hosting U.S. military assets that were used in the war against Iran. And also, Iran has retaliated by firing missiles and drones at many Saudi targets during the course of the war, including U.S. military assets, but also energy targets and infrastructure targets to a more limited degree. So this Pakistan has a basically secret agreement with Saudi Arabia, a mutual defense agreement. The existence of the agreement itself has been known and announced various times, but the terms of it were never really shared either with the public media or even with the Pakistani public and the parliament and so forth. It's always remained classified. We received that agreement, the classified agreement, and we wrote about it at Dropsite last week. So the issue is in the current conflict, if the talks break down, the Pakistani government does not want to be put in a position where it will be forced to enforce this mutual defense treaty and fight Iran in defense of Saudi Arabia. That would be very problematic for the Pakistani government. It doesn't want to get involved in the war, but it also wants to keep the Saudis happy with the agreement. So that's kind of the hidden subtext of these talks, where Pakistan really has an urgent need to keep the war, you know, not happening, to keep the ceasefire from breaking down, not just because it doesn't want to see the war in the neighborhood, because it doesn't want to be put into the war itself.
So tell us about some of the terms of this treaty. I mean, whenever I hear mutual defense treaty, I mean, obviously that's what NATO is essentially. Right. But, you know, I think of World War I and the build up to that, the intertangling alliances in Europe and in the Middle East that sort of, you know, caused an archduke taking a wrong turn to lead to global conflagration. What are some of the, what are some of the triggers that put this treaty into effect, and how does it, what does it look like if and when it is activated?
So the treaty itself, it commits, it actually is interesting because at least as of 2024, it didn't really put any stated reciprocal stipulations on Saudi Arabia. It was more about Pakistan protecting Saudi Arabia. And notably, it was about the deployment of Pakistani troops.
So it's not so mutual.
At least, there's gone through multiple iterations, and we have iterations going from the 80s to 2024. And up to that point, there was no reciprocal, obligations on Saudi Arabia. There was a new version updated in 2025, which we didn't have a copy of, which, you know, theoretically could alter it such that Saudi Arabia offers mutual defense obligations. But I don't think so, because there have been Pakistani armed conflicts since then. There's currently a war in Afghanistan that Pakistan's involved in, and Saudi Arabia has not involved itself in that war or suggested even that it would do so. So they really have limited capacity to help Pakistan in any conflicts. The mutual obligation really does seem to be quite one-sided, despite the denominator.
So what does Pakistan get out of this? Is just into sort of respectability or what?
Well, in theory, although it's not stated in the agreement, we can glean this from the statements of Pakistani officials, is that their goal in the agreement is to get financial support and investment from Saudi Arabia in exchange for offering a defense umbrella to Saudi territory to the Pakistani military. Now, it's not really clear to what degree that obligation has really been satisfied or that implicit obligation. Saudi Arabia is not a huge investor in Pakistan. It could be a corrupt deal where they're off the books agreements with certain Pakistani military leaders to pay them, to give them financial rewards in exchange for this agreement. That could be the case. It would make a lot of sense. There's a lot of deep elite connections between the two countries. On top of that, maybe there could be in the future Saudi investments in Pakistan's defense industrial base. And they do have a significant defense sector. They manufacture aircrafts and weapons and so forth. They obviously have a nuclear program. Those things could all be there. But the Pakistanis have publicly in recent months expressed frustration we've seen in the press about what they see as a lack of actual reward from the agreement. So at the same time, the Pakistanis have also, despite this agreement existing for a long time, they've really always tried to avoid having to honor it, in the sense when the Saudis have tried to induce them to fight in Yemen or maybe even now fight in Iran, they've really done everything they can to avoid having to enforce the agreement. They really don't want to enforce it. So it really shows you the weakness of the agreement to date, at least. It's not like NATO or something where there's very strong stipulations, at least in the past, to enforce an alliance. It's much more touch and go, you could say, as per the agreement so far.
Murtaza, it's a little bit strange for, I think, a lot of American ears to sort of think that the Saudis, who are swimming in cash and are suddenly in need of assistance, military, from a country as desperately poor as Pakistan is comparatively. That comes at the same time as this report that that Trump is considering using U.S. tax dollars to compensate the UAE for the damage that they've sustained during the Israel-U.S. attack on Iran. And it's kind of like, well, we have Americans sleeping outside and we're sending money to the Emiratis? I mean, are we misreading the financial relationship here?
Well, that's the sad thing about one of the many sad things about this whole episode. It just shows how democracy has been so degraded to such that it's just these guys these elites, transnational elites, who have these relationships with each other. Obviously, Trump and his son-in-law and many others have very close ties with people in the Gulf who are also very wealthy. They're just all bailing each other out, and the U.S. military is being deployed as, you know, like a gang in practice to serve the interests of this small group of networked elite people in the U.S. or Tel Aviv or Abu Dhabi or Riyadh or wherever else. So it really has no... Yeah, you're absolutely right. Why would we be bailing out these very wealthy people? Why are we even spending billions of dollars a day fighting this war in the first place when there's all these pressing problems at home? And the Trump administration specifically campaigned on the idea that it was going to deploy resources at home and not just not fight wars abroad, specifically not fight an Iran war. That mm-hmm. was a war that they campaigned against specifically. And now they're doing it. So it really shows institutional breakdown. You know, you can't help but be a bit cynical about it. And the midterms are coming up. Inflation is going to be really high by the time of the midterms. This blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, it's already affecting people in Asia and Africa and elsewhere. It's really going to start affecting Europe and the United States in the weeks and months ahead. So people are going to be really, really upset about that. And whatever, I think that anything else Trump promised he's going to do in this administration, it's just going to be out the window at this point. He's just going to be dealing with the consequences of this decision. that's pretty much all that's going to be happening, economic and political and otherwise.
Murtaza, I couldn't agree more. So before you came on, Jamal and I were kind of bandying about the current state of the ceasefire negotiations that Pakistan is brokering or trying to broker. First of all, one quick question. Do you think that the message that went out from the Pakistan prime minister last night asking, quote unquote, the Americans to return to extend the deadline and to allow more space for diplomatic negotiations. Do you think that one was like the last one from a couple of weeks ago, authored in Washington and then sent to him and he posted it?
Maybe. I don't have a great faith in the Pakistanis as mediators in the situation. Although I do think that they do sincerely want to see an end to the war. And inside Pakistan, which is a neighboring country of Iran, there's tremendous sympathy for Iran because they believe that they were victims of aggression in this case, in this war. So I do think that they want to end the war. It's just that the Pakistani military government is not really independent from Washington. We've done a lot of reporting about this at Dropsite and even before that. They are very dependent. They're very keen on winning the favor of Trump, and they want to please Trump in the situation. So that has to be balanced against whatever ostensibly neutral role as an interlocutor they're playing or a mediator that they're playing here. So, because of that, they're very incentivized to portray things as more positive than they are, to put more pressure on the Iranians to agree to American positions rather than vice versa. And, you know, they've probably done some good things. They've probably helped egg along the Lebanon ceasefire and just encourage everyone to get back to the table and so forth. But despite that, I'm not sure that they could really. It's possible that they're the ones who are conveying messages for Trump through their own auspices.
Because Trump clearly is the one who, he blusters and bluffs, and then he gets caught out, and then he wants to, and his way out, as he sees it, is to be seen as fake it, as benevolently granting more negotiations that the world wants, when really it's he who wants it desperately.
Yeah, absolutely. He wants, and the Iranians, we were talking to them, they're not desperate to have a deal here. They actually would prefer to fight than to sign what they see as a bad deal.
Because they're waiting for the world markets to tank. They know time is on their side if they can hold out.
They're waiting for the world markets to tank, and also their perspective, they're fighting a war for existence. This is like their second war of independence. They're not thinking about midterms or, you know, short-term inflation and things like that. They see it as they're fighting for survival, and they could fight for years if they have to. They already fought a previous war in the 80s against Saddam Hussein, which the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein in that war. Mm-hmm. Years, and a million people were killed in the war. They saw it as a war for survival, so they're willing to pay a huge cost. It's the same thing now. Whereas for Trump, this Iran situation, he just kind of got into it without thinking about it too much, it seems. It was one of many things that he wants to get off his checklist, so to speak. He doesn't have the same investment emotionally or ideologically in having a war to the death with the Iranians. So, you know, the time preferences favor the Iranians here for numerous reasons. And even Trump's strategy of trying to change the time preference by putting this blockade on the Iranians and so forth. Two things. They have a lot of slack in the system in Iran. They have an oil storage space domestically. A lot of tankers seem to still be getting by despite the blockade. And finally, even if it resulted in damage to their oil production or huge, significant drop in oil sales and so forth, that's a price they're willing to pay because they're fighting for survival. And it's happened in the past in the 2020s when the 19, when Trump put his maximum pressure sanctions, Iranian oil exports went almost to zero for quite a long time. They didn't collapse at that time, so why would they collapse now? When they also have this reciprocal blockade in the Strait of Hormuz. So it really doesn't make any sense. It's a horrible decision he made to get in this war. He's trying to find one solution to get out of it. I think there's two likely options here. Well, actually, there's three options. First, the war could start again, which I see is possible, but the least likely option. The second is that Trump capitulates in some way and makes an agreement, which is kind of like the Iran deal that Obama made.
JCPOA.
Or, and this could actually be the most likely outcome, and I've seen other people assess this as well, and I agree with it, is that Trump could just walk away. He could say, we're done with this. we smashed the situation. We broke the status quo here. It's worse now. The Iranians control the strait. We don't want to make a deal with them. So let's just leave and let everyone else, you know, sort things out.
The problem with option three, though, is that it leaves the strait under Iranian control, and therefore, you know, the global economy hangs in the balance. And, you know, you can only imagine all the phone calls Trump is taking from world leaders and corporate leaders saying, please make the pain stop.
Exactly. I think that's why he's still in it right now. But the issue is, there's only two ways of making the pain stop. Is one, you do it militarily, you force it all. But it seems like they can't do that because it's not that hard to shut down the strait. You have to actually invade Iran and probably overthrow the government.
The whole thing.
Yeah, it's a country of 90 million people.
Impossible.
Europe, impossible. So that's a really unattractive option. And secondly, is you can make a deal to open it. So that's the logical thing. But if he can't bring himself to do that.
What about normalization? I've been saying that that's Trump's way out. I mean, I know it's like radical, but, you know, literally just say, I mean, Trump had floated that in the 2016 election saying, I would talk to the mullahs. I would talk to the ayatollahs. I would go to Tehran, you know, like bring Iran back into the fold and say, hey, we're friends now. The fight's over.
I think that would be entailed making a comprehensive deal with them. But I think it's very difficult because you'd have to give them things in that situation. Mm-hmm. You see, very unwilling to make durable concessions or credible concessions because in D.C. there are a lot of people who will fight tooth and nail, even if he wanted to make a deal, to undermine it, to destroy it, and so forth. And, you know, I don't see that he's a very – Trump's negotiating style is very zero-sum. And, you know, it's interesting. Last week it seemed like they almost had a deal, to be honest, or something edging on a deal theoretically. And Trump really single-handedly destroyed it by going on social media and – claiming that the Iranians agreed to everything and he's giving them nothing, just, you know, just completely trying to humiliate them after the deal was made. They didn't respond well to that.
No.
So I don't know if he's, you know, his internal, he's capable of making the conciliatory, you know, gestures and concessions necessary to make a deal.
In his history suggests that.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a very sensitive negotiation. And, you know, the Iran nuclear deal, the original one, took almost 2 years of sensitive messaging and talks to bring to conclusion. Very delicate situation. It's hard to imagine Trump being able to do that now. It'd be great if he did, but that's just probably, you know, not maybe the most likely outcome here.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you on that. Would you be willing to take a question from one of our viewers?
Sure.
Manchild, thanks for the donation. Is Pakistan just a high-end mercenary force now? With the Saudis paying the bills, has the world's only Muslim nuclear power basically pawned its nukes to Riyadh in order to avoid going broke?
Well, you know, one interesting thing in these documents that I should have brought up, and it was actually very fascinating, is that in this mutual defense agreement, the Pakistanis specifically delimited it to exclude the nuclear weapon. That's interesting because for many, many years, we'd assumed that Pakistan had given a nuclear umbrella to Saudi Arabia. And some Pakistani civilian officials had even suggested that was the case. But as per the terms of the agreement, they went out of their way to make sure that that was not considered part of the agreement. Now, that may have changed in the 2025 version. But again, I haven't seen any evidence suggest that no missile silos or basing being done in Saudi Arabia visible to anybody else that would suggest that's the case. So, yeah, they actually have tried to not have that part of there, which is a very interesting revelation from the documents.
Ted, do you mind if I piggyback on this real quick?
Please.
If that's the case, then what's the point? I mean, well, the biggest actor in the Middle East, in this case, from Saudi Arabian standpoint, is Iran. And so what's the goal? To get Pakistan to effectively on the hook if there's a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Is that the thought?
Well, so this is the thing. So basically, the deal itself does not, and also they specifically made sure that the language suggested this, it does not require or obligate Pakistan to engage in foreign conflicts on behalf of Saudi Arabia. It's only about deployment of troops to Saudi territory to defend the government against a threat. So in 2015, the Saudis tried to activate it when they're going to war in Yemen, to get the Pakistanis to go fight in Yemen. But that was vetoed by the Pakistani parliament, and the deal itself also does not really accommodate that. And, you know, this deal, as it currently structured, it would not suggest Pakistan would fight in Iran, for instance, or attack Iranian assets. It does suggest, and it's happening now, that they would deploy Pakistani ground troops to Saudi Arabia to maybe defend critical assets inside the country from attack. And also very key, the Pakistani Air Force. Pakistan is a very large, sophisticated air force. Many of those planes are currently in Saudi Arabia, or some number of them are in Saudi Arabia, to defend you against drones or missiles. So, you know, that's kind of the way it seems that the treaty is written and also being implemented. It's a treaty to defend Saudi Arabia against attack, and also potentially defend Saudi Arabia against internal security crisis. Maybe if there was a rebellion inside Saudi Arabia, theoretically, the deal does not exclude Pakistan from defending the Saudi royal family against that. So yeah, it's kind of like a military contractor agreement, absent any sort of reciprocal Saudi military concession, which I haven't seen. I think that's kind of how people would interpret it.
Thank you so much for joining us. Murtaza, where can people find your work?
Thanks. I'm at Dropside News, and you can find me on X and Substack as well, too.
Murtaza, I hope you'll come back. That was really great.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you so much. Murtaza Hussain is a reporter for Dropsite News. He's specializes in national security and foreign policy. He's a former reporter for The Intercept and offers commentary on U.S. interventions, human rights, and global affairs, and appears regularly on the big networks like CNN, BBC, and MS Now. All right, so that was cool. We should talk about... we should take, first of all, a few little super chats we have to get to. Count Zero, thanks for the £2. Need more Robbie. More Robbie you shall have, especially in the next hour if you stay tuned to TMI, because it'll just be me and Robbie. Jabari Media, thanks for the $9.99. So Robbie brought up the Confederacy, so I had to ask, are you saying that you're a non-racist Confederate? And if so, what does that mean? And why are Black people born like my family excluded, Robbie?
Well, the Confederacy doesn't exist, so it'd be very hard for me to be a racist Confederate. So I'm just kind of put that out there. Second, I really don't know how else that I can say this. Americans have a very difficult problem with oversimplifying things and putting everything into a cartoon wrapper. The good guys don't always wear black, or don't always wear white, and the bad guys don't always wear black. American history is very complicated. It's always been complicated. It's always going to be complicated. So trying to put things into this good, bad paradigm, it just doesn't work. If you go through, if you study American history, you're going to see so much contradiction. You're going to see so much double dealing. You're going to see... I mean, you're going to see it all in terms of the war between the states. It comes down to ultimately to what your politics are at the end of the day. Is the federal government a creation of the states, or are the states a creation of the federal government? Which one has supremacy? That's the question. I'm a states' rights guy. I believe that the Constitution is a dead document. It says what it says, and it cannot be interpreted to the times. That's the whole issue. The Constitution is a bill of negative rights. It tells the federal government what it is allowed to do. And anything that's not in the Constitution, per the 9th and 10th Amendments, are reserved to the states and specifically to the
government
people.
What it's not allowed to do. But we do have to talk about one more topic here. And Robbie, why don't you just stay on, because I think you'll have thoughts about this. Okay. So Trump has just, we anticipated that this would happen, and now it has. Trump has officially asked Congress to increase the U.S. defense budget by 42%. So to put that into perspective,
42%
to $1.5 trillion. That's 42% over last year. And that's 2/3 of an increase over Biden's last budget, 2024. To help pay for that, he wants to gut domestic spending, getting rid of medical research, job training, home, which is a Ted Rall thing. I think job training is super important. Home heating assistance. Yeah, because let's let people freeze to death in the winter. Environmental protection and disaster relief after tornadoes and hurricanes. At a private luncheon on Easter Sunday, Trump said, "We're fighting wars. It's not possible for us to take care of daycare, Medicaid, Medicare." A lovely man. Will Trump get his way? Will Congress, which always votes yes on defense spending, not only votes yes, but usually gives the Defense Department a tip? It usually gives them more appropriations than they request. So what will happen this time? I mean, this is by far the biggest defense increase in U.S. history.
Fuck it. I mean, like, it, I know that sounds brutal, but look, man, like, the idea that a president would even say that is amazing. We spend $1 trillion. We spend more than, what, like, 9 of the next countries combined in regards to the military. The president is choosing to go to war. So the idea that you're choosing wars of aggression and then turn around and say, hey, man, we need more money because I need to fight wars. The guy who got in office screaming about peace and attacking Joe Biden for fighting wars. That's outrageous. Will he get it? I don't know. Put it this way. I don't think he's going to be able to gut those agencies because I think there'll be consequences for doing so. But would he get the money? That may be a separate matter. They may just
I think he would do it. I don't think he cares. And I've said this before. I think it just goes to show how not just disdain that our ruling class has for us, but the absolute hatred. If you're a parent, and if you're always neglecting your kids and you go over to your neighbor's house and you keep taking their kids to Disney, before long, your kids realize that your dad hates you. That's our government. That's what this is.
Ted?
Guys, close out the show for me.
Oh, okay. Well, we've come to the end. Shout out to Ted Rault. Shout out to Robbie. My name is Jamal Thomas. You guys are listening to Deprogrammed, and we will see you bright and early tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We may see you later today for Q&A, but at the very least, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Be safe. Be kind. Love, peace, and soul.
Have a good one, y'all. Stay tuned for TMI.
And we are away. I did count that on streaming for BMI. Okay. All right, guys,
yeah.
Be safe.
Yeah, it's harder whenever usually Manila sets up the room. So whenever we're having to do this, it just makes it a lot more difficult. So,
I see. Okay.
Yeah, so
I was confused. I'm sorry.
No, I was confused. No, you are good. But stay tuned for TMI. Right. I will be writing us over there now.
Have a good one, guys.